An Egyptian broker's ceasefire kicks into effect in the besieged Gaza Strip after 5 days of Israeli strikes that claimed over 30 Palestinian lives. People hold rallies across the world to mark Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, and denounce Israeli atrocities in the Gaza Strip and occupied West Bank. And Moscow accuses Ukraine of using British long-range cruise missiles to target two industrial sites in the Russian-held city of Luhansk. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, after 5 days of Israeli strikes on Gaza, ceasefire has officially kicked into effect in the besieged enclave. Egyptian-mediated truce ended the worst episode of fighting since a 10-day war in 2021. Palestinian resistance movement, the Islamic Jihad, said it will abide by the ceasefire as long as the regime does. In a statement, Joint Operations Room of the Palestinian Resistance Factions also said the Palestinian resistance groups are stronger than ever. Latest Israeli violence erupted when the Israeli regime that has targeted a number of residential areas in Gaza on Tuesday, killing several Islamic Jihad commanders. A total of 33 Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in 5 days of Israeli attacks. In response, Palestinian resistance groups fired over 1,200 rockets towards Israel, targeting as far as Tel Aviv. An Israeli settler was killed and dozens injured. And earlier, we're joined by our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who gave us the latest on the truce deal.
The Palestinian resistance factions, mainly the Islamic Jihad and its military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, launched some 1,100 rockets at the Israeli regime, proving once again the failure of the multi-billion dollar so-called Iron Dome missile interception system, where it was only able to destroy 30% of the 30% of the rockets that were fired from Gaza. The use of a new rocket, Barak 85, by the Islamic Jihad, has also forced the Israeli regime to use another type of missile interception system called David Sling. Over the last half an hour, the Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad, Ziad Nakhala, talked about the truce and talked about the steadfastness of the Islamic Jihad and the Palestinian resistance in light of this latest Israeli aggression. Many here believe that this is not the last Israeli assault or onslaught against Gaza, but Palestinians say they are ready to face any Israeli aggressions against them.
People across the world have held rallies to show solidarity with Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip and occupied West Bank. Rallies come ahead of the anniversary of the creation of Israel, known as the Day of Nakba, or Catastrophe. Rallies were held in many cities across the world, including Vienna, Rotterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Toronto. The demonstrators also slammed "Worlds in Action" and "Silence" over constant Israeli atrocities, calling on governments and international organizations to take immediate action. In London, protesters chanted slogans denouncing the UK's role in the creation of the Israeli regime. Nakba Day marks the creation of Israel in 1948, Witness who had moved to Palestine from various countries committed ethnic cleansing there and colonized Palestinian land. The process saw over 750,000 Palestinians driven into exile and more than 500 towns and villages wiped off the map.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctions on Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanctions on Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long. And we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15-1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label We cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of people have once again taken to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest against judicial reforms proposed by the cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The demonstrators held up flares and chanted slogans against Netanyahu, with many saying the surge in the onslaught on Palestinians and recent attacks on Gaza is an attempt to divert attention from the regime's internal crisis. Israelis have been holding similar rallies for 19 consecutive weeks now, despite Netanyahu's decision to put the plans on hold. The so-called reforms will give the cabinet greater control over the judiciary. Critics say it will remove vital checks and balances and hand unchecked powers to the cabinet. Now, the Iranian Army's Navy says it is conducting its first around-the-world mission aimed at promoting peace worldwide. Chief Commander of Iranian's Army Navy Force, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, said the missions carried out by the 86th Naval Fleet, comprising the Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship. He added mission started in September 2022 from Iran's southern port city of Bandar Abbas. Admiral Irani said fleet is now in the Gulf of Aden, noting it's visited several countries, including India and Indonesia. Moscow says Ukraine has used British long-range cruise missiles to target two industrial sites in the Russian-held city of Luhansk.
For this strike, Storm Shadow missiles were used that had been supplied to Kiev regime by Great Britain, despite London's declarations that they would not be used against civilian objects. As a result of the strike, the fire broke out at the chemical and food processing plants. Neighboring residential buildings were hit as well. Civilians were hurt, among them six children. Russian air forces took down the Ukrainian Su-24, who carried out the strike, as well as MiG-29 that covered it.
Defense Ministry said the Russian forces have gained control over another block in eastern city of Bakhmut, but a senior Ukrainian military commander said Kiev's forces are advancing along parts of the front line near Bakhmut. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Italy has concluded after meetings with the country's top officials and head of the Vatican, Pope Francis. Max Civilli has your story.
Italy's top officials reiterated Rome's full support for Kiev during Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's one-day visit to the Italian capital. On Saturday, meetings between Zelensky and Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni took place amid heightened security measures across the city centre, including a no-fly zone ordered for Rome's skies and police snipers strategically placed on high buildings. Zelensky received pledges of open-ended continued military and financial support by Italy's government.
We are betting on Ukraine's victory. I reiterated to my friend Volodymyr Zelensky that Italy will continue to back his country for as long as necessary. Also, we acknowledge and support Kyiv's European Union ambitions.
Since the war began 15 months ago, Italy has provided over 1 billion euros in financial and military aid, including the costly SAMP-T air defense system, which has for itself a value of around 800 million euros. This, despite polls have been showing for about a year that more than half of the Italians are against sending weapons to Kiev, and tens of anti-war protests have been staged across the country. After meeting Italy's top officials, Zelensky held talks with Pope Francis. The Holy See has repeatedly offered its readiness to act as a peacemaker in the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. According to some analysts, the Vatican taking the role of mediator is an option that upsets chancelleries of many Western states.
Western Chancellery's opposition to the Vatican working for peace in Ukraine is paradoxical and contradictory. Paradoxical because a ceasefire would be beneficial for all the parties involved, and contradictory because key Chinese diplomats will start touring Europe on Monday. And my feeling is that Western governments will be more inclined to accept China's mediation on the Ukraine crisis rather than that of Pope Francis.
The Vatican is reportedly involved in a behind-the-scenes peace mission, but so far no details have been disclosed. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has confirmed such an initiative. Earlier this week, Pope Francis met with Russia's outgoing ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdeyev. Some Italian media have reported that the envoy may have been given a letter for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
In Turkey are set to cast their ballots in presidential and parliamentary elections on Sunday. Elections are a litmus test, that is, for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development, or AK, party. 64 million people are eligible to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Around 2 million Turkish nationals living abroad have already cast their ballots. Incumbent Erdogan is among four candidates approved by the country's electoral body. According to recent opinion polls, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition party, is another front-runner in the race. Candidates held a final campaign rally on Friday to try to woo many of the 5 million first-time voters. A runoff is expected 2 weeks if none of the presidential candidates crosses the 50% threshold needed to win in the first round. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. More Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2021 than in any other year on record, according to the latest available statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. That included record numbers of both gun murders and gun suicides. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Recent international note in this regard, Texas is setting a new record for mass killings. A day after a gunman killed 8 people and injured 7 others north of Dallas, Texas, the driver of a Land Rover drove into a group of migrants waiting at a bus stop, killing 8 on Sunday, May 7th. 10 people were injured. The attack occurred in Brownsville, Texas, near the border with Mexico. The driver of the Land Rover, identified as George Alvarez, was initially charged with reckless driving, according to police. Also on Monday, May 8th morning, the police charged him with 8 counts of manslaughter. The police said they had not yet determined whether the act was intentional. Alvarez had a record that included prior charges of assault and driving while intoxicated, according to police. After the Brownsville killing, he tried to flee the scene, but witnesses held him until the police arrived.
Police Chief Felix Suda said at a news conference that the department was waiting results of former toxicology tests. Alvarez was not cooperating, the police said. In the mall shooting in Allen, Texas, the alleged gunman died after a confrontation with police at the Allen Premium Outlets, the scene of the shooting, Allen Police Department officials said on Saturday, May 6th. The hospitalized victims' ages ranges from 5 to 61 years old, authorities said. There was a surreal scene after the shooting. Shoppers at the Allen Premium Outlets were ordered to come out with their hands in the air, presumably to ensure nobody was carrying a weapon or was an accomplice in the shooting. After the latest massacre in Dallas, there was a string of vacuous statements from American officials. President Joe Biden called on Congress to pass an assault weapons ban following the Texas mall mass shooting. Yesterday, an assailant in tactical gear armed with an AR-15-style assault weapon gunned down innocent people in a shopping mall. And not for the first time. Such an attack is too shocking to be so familiar, Biden said in a statement released on Sunday, May 7th, adding, "And yet, American communities have suffered roughly 200 mass shootings already this year. According to leading counts, more than 14,000 of our fellow citizens have lost their lives," credible estimates show. The leading cause of death for American kids is gun violence. Vice President Kamala Harris intoned in equally somber tone, saying, "All Americans deserve to be safe from gun violence." She also urged Congress to act. She said in a statement, "Doc and I mourn for the 8 adults and children who lost their lives, pray for those wounded, and send our gratitude to the first responders who ran toward danger. All Americans deserve to be safe from gun violence, but they are not," Harris continued. "Not because we do not know the solutions. Not because the American people are divided on this issue. Even a majority of gun owners support sensible reforms," Harris added. "We need action." Despite such pleas, why is there no let-up in gun violence in the United States of America? In 2021, there were 48,830 deaths from gun-related injuries, according to the latest data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. That's nearly an 8% increase from 2020, which was a record-breaking year for firearm deaths. In Mexico, by comparison, there were 22,116 gun-related deaths in the year 2019. Data shows more than 50 people are killed each day by a firearm in the U.S., according to the CDC. That's a significantly larger portion of homicides than in the case in neighboring Canada at 37%. Why is gun-related violence so prevalent in the United States? Some people say that it is the number of guns in private hands in the U.S., estimated at 390 million in 2018, according to the Swiss-based research project, the Small Arms Survey. The U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents, up from 88 per 100 in 2011, far surpasses that of other countries around the world. So one must look elsewhere to seek answers to the very high rate of gun-related killings in the U.S. Violence is glorified in American culture. It is projected on television as well as in video games. When Americans murder millions of innocent people abroad in the endless wars of aggression, it is applauded at home. In the U.S., the police shoot first and ask questions later, if at all.
It is said that violence is as American as apple pie. When the culture of violence is glorified in America, it is not surprising that people would resort to it at the first opportunity. School mass shootings have escalated. Nowhere else in the world are children murdered in such high numbers as in the U.S. Welcome to the land of the freaks.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints,
the presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Kalav Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the holy character of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, Ja'far ibn Muhammad, mainly known as Ja'far al-Sadiq. Although he's regarded as the sixth Shiite Imam, but our Sunni brethren have respect for him too, because so many of the outstanding ulama and the scholars and the first generation of the scholars of the other denominations rather than Shiite Islam have been the students, direct student of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. And today we want to talk about how is it possible that on that time Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq taught so many students from the other denominations of Islam. So, Sayyid Mohsen, let's start with you. So how is it that Imam Sadiq has taught the main pioneers and the forerunners of the fiqhiyya school of thought of the other denominations rather than Shia Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, as you mentioned, is the sixth Imam, Imam. And he was Imam for 34 years. And after that, he was martyred by the Umayyad caliphates. Now, since there was a dispute, or we can say a fight between the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates, these two rulers, and Abbasid wanted to take over the whole Muslim land.
Yes,
that was the best time for Imam Sadiq alayhi salam to preach, because at the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin, after the incidents of Karbala, he was under the observation.
Yes,
somehow Imam Baqir alayhi salam was also, but
so it was an interval between Umayyads and the Abbasids.
And the Abbasids.
So for the short time of the Marwanids, Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq found a chance.
Because, yes. Imam Sadiq has seen five caliphates of Umayyad and two caliphates of Abbasid.
Yes.
Till Mansur Dawanqi.
Okay.
So this was a time for him, because the rulers, they were after their own fights and all those. So he basically, he paid more attention to the educational aspect or the preaching aspect of the
Imam was
Islam.
Not after the power, Sayyid, isn't it?
Imam, look, we cannot say like Imam is not after the power. This is one of the duties of Imam.
Yes.
But since he did not have those companions, you know, the way Imam Hussein alayhi salam has said, the companions that I had, even the Prophet or Imam Ali or other, did not have it. Because if Imam Hassan had this many companions, he would also, you know, he never goes towards, you know, having the treaty with Muawiyah.
Yes.
And Imam Ali alayhi salam, even when he lost the battle in the Safin after the Khawarij has, you know, they went against him. This was just because of these companions. So the main matter is when the Imam is there, it's his duty.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, does he have those circumstances to take over or not? And at this time, when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is in the occultation, it is also because of the same reason, that the circumstances are not in a way that he comes and he rules over the world. So
they say that Abu Muslim Khorasan is sent Imam al-Sadiq so many letters that, okay, now you are the leader of the Shiite world, come and be the, for example, leader of the whole, but it was all negated by the Imam.
Obviously,
on that time.
Even Abu Muslim Khorasani, he wasn't having control over the whole Khorasan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to raise the way the Zayd Shahid raised incident of Karbala. We have Hussein Fakh. There were different people who raised for taking the revenge of Imam Hussein or having the Shia, we can say, like rulership. But obviously, they were very small in number and they were not so much effective the way they should be. So that's why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he basically started preaching the religion in the in the Medina. And we can see like different scholars, they started to come to see Imam alayhi salam.
I will get back to the scholars from the other denominations. But before that, Shaykh Rouhani, they say that it was the system of wakala was for the first time established at the time of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, isn't it? And continued to up to Imam al-As. I mean, the minor occultation and then the major occultation. What was this wakala system? I mean, instead of being the official ruler of the Muslim land, Imam has selected the system of wakala. Then the monies come, then the students come, then the systems are shaped, okay, all around the Muslim lands. And gradually, a kind of new system of thought, without having the official power, but in the deep layers of the societies of the Muslim lands, is now in the hands of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. I think it's what be interesting for some dear listeners to be familiar with this concept.
Yes, of course, as you rightly mentioned, Imam as-Sadiq alayhi salatu wassalam, in reality, he was the leader for the Muslim Ummah. Even nowadays, if you refer to the Sunni scholars, they accept that the role of Ahlul Bayt is like a scholarly role or a spiritual role, or you can say spiritual leadership or scholarly leadership goes to these Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
Because all of the Imams of them, like Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanafi, and the rest of the Imams, they were like the students of the Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, particularly Imam Azam Abu Hanifa, as they titled. He was one of the students of him.
Yes.
And he is the one who has the most, the majority of the Sunni people are following this Abu Hanifa.
Hanafis,
yes. So that's why when it comes to the scholarly leadership or the spiritual leadership, every Muslim even nowadays accepted that Ahlul Bayt was in such a position. And the other point that you rightly mentioned was this, that because leadership needs, we can say, budget or let's say money to help to support the real Muslims in, as much as possible. So that's why A'imma alayhi salatu wasalam, particularly from the Imam Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam and the other Imams, they established this system of wakala. They had representatives among the people. They were gathered, the questions of the people, the problems of the people, and also sometimes the khums or wujuhat, as we can say in Islam. So they were sent to the imam.
Okay.
One of the reasons, the main reason for the animosity of the Abbasid rulers or caliphs against this imam was this, that they feared this system. Because they feared this system.
Although they were not officially
announcing any
uprising against the official power.
Because they knew that they have lots of supporters among Muslims.
Oh.
For example, look, when Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam were coming to the city of Marv, in the way from Medina to Marv, particularly when he approached the Khorasan, then the, let's say, Ma'mun's, let's say, soldiers saw that, okay, sometimes thousands of people gather in a place to listen to the Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. They were confused. They were shocked. Okay, how is it possible that the Imam had connection to these number of people in Khorasan? While Ma'mun is, for example, officially
And this was the main reason for martyring and poisoning the imams?
Poisoning them.
Okay.
That was the reason. Okay. And the other point that we can mention is that how much strong was the rule of these representatives or wakala among the people, that they taught the people to love Ahlul Bayt, to listen to Ahlul Bayt, to actually to be the followers of Ahlul Bayt. Because of that, in Nishabur, we see that thousands of people gathered to listen to Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. And we have hadith, Silsilatul Dhahab, with the golden chain, from Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, that Sunni, Shia, and all Muslims were gathered there. And tens of narrators narrated these hadiths. So the question is that why did they gather?
Yes.
In that place.
Yes.
While Imam was not officially the leader. But you see that spiritually and scholarly, Imam was the leader.
Yes. That's and Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam had a very special role in reviving Sha'air. They say that for the first time, this was Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam who get the companions to the real burial place of Imam Ali alayhi salam, because it was hidden. Hidden, okay, on that time. Again, Sha'air al-Husayni are very much indebted to Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. How you should mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. The Ziyara text. These are very important, we can say, heritage and the legacy of the Shiites were all indebted to the presence of Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now let's get back to the Faraq, I mean the denominations of Islam, the important ones. We know that out of all this, name them for us, Sayyid Mohsen. What are they and who were the leaders and how they are linked to Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam?
Well, obviously, first of all, we need to know that Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam was known as Yabna Rasulillah, the son of the messenger of God.
Okay.
And he has a special rank or status amongst the people.
Yes.
Every single Muslim, they used to respect them because of their link that they had with the Prophet, and they're from the lineage of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And they knew that in every time there is an Imam, there is an authority.
Yes.
And even at time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we have seen how the caliphates, they used to go to Imam Ali to ask the questions, and how the people later, they respect Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. And similarly with Imam Zainul Abidin and Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam. So the firaq or the schools which were started, it wasn't in this way at that time. There was a political, we can say, difference. And initially in Islam, we had those who believed that Imam Ali is the right successor of the Prophet after the Prophet, and the others, they used to think like they believe that this caliphate system that started in Islam, this is the right way. Now, the interesting thing is that Imam Abu Hanifa Nu'man, it was his real name, he believed that Imam Ali is the right successor of the Prophet.
Okay.
And after him, his students as well, they also believe that the Imam Ali alayhi salam is the right successor of the Prophet. So this was the general belief. And even, you know, the Imam Abu Hanifa had, you know, these, he was punished for this this belief that he had by the Umayyad caliphates.
Okay.
That why you are preaching this.
Yes.
Yes, he was a scholar on his own, Imam Abu Hanifa, and he used to, you know, give his own ideas about the things. But later when he went to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and he saw that Imam Sadiq has started to preach the true Islam, he came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and there we see that his famous sentence that Lawla sanatan la halak al-Nu'man. If I haven't spent 2 years as a student of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, I would have been, you know, died, or I was like, you know, I was no one. So basically, this shows the status of Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. And from there, obviously, he learned. But the point is, the different schools that we see, these were made by governments. You know, this thing. Why? Because as a belief, Imam Abu Hanifa was believing that Imam Ali is the successful, the right successor of the Prophet. On the other hand, he has his own ideas about the jurisprudence,
yes,
which was supported by the governments. Later, Imam Malik came, and he was the student.
Ahmad ibn Hanbal, Shafi'i, the next generation.
Okay. Yes. So the direct student of Imam Abu Hanifa was Imam Malik, who was the student of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam as well. He was also supported by the governments of that time.
Okay.
And he wrote a book with the name of Muwatta. Which still exists amongst the books.
Yes.
Now, why this book is still amongst the people and why it became famous, it was because the government supported them. Whereas the Ahlul Bayt, because they were not supported by the rulers of the time, even the rulers, they went against the Ahlul Bayt, they fought against the Ahlul Bayt. For example, the Umayyad Caliphate system, the Abbasid even, they were also against the Aima alayhi salatu wasalam. So that was one of the reasons and the major reason that in future, or in the next years, we see that after Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when these people, they become the students and supported by these caliphates or, you know, the rulers,
yes,
we see the deviation in the Islamic, mm-hmm. in the Islam, yes, as the school of thoughts.
Yes.
Like Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, Hanbali.
But they were all one, I think, isn't it? Under the shadow of the teachings of, as you said, the most knowledgeable man of, yes, Islam. That is Imam Jafar.
That's why we see, okay, in all these school of thoughts, you see they have some parts which goes back to what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said.
Yes.
And if you join all of them, you see that the main idea which they are following is what was said by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So this was the main deviation where, from where this started.
Right. Okay.
And it was backed by the governments. Because the governments of that time, they never wanted the Ahlul Bayt to come forward and to rule. And if everything has been said by Ahlul Bayt, then they would have lost, yes, their, you know, rulership.
Yes. Another important struggle of Imam Jafar al-Sadiq was acting against the exaggerators. I mean, although he was an infallible imam, he believed in Imam Ali alayhi salam as the truthful successor of Prophet Muhammad, but there were still some exaggerators who believed that, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam is God, a kind of rububiyah status for an imam, okay? Or he reached prophethood. So Imam Sadiq, Imam al-Baqir, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in very explicit ahadith, explain that. Do not sit down with exaggerators. Do not shake hand with them. Do not eat food with them, okay? These are the enemies of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt. This shows how much he was committed to the, we can say, truth of the idea of the leadership and imama. Okay, Shaykh Rouhani. So, what about other efforts of Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam? I mean, any political, social, cultural reform or something like that?
You know, after the event of Ashura, in the Battle of Karbala, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam with his companions were martyred in that way, mm-hmm. then Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salatu wasalam was imprisoned, actually, by, yes, the Amawid caliphs and Marwanid caliphs. So it seems that there was no any room or any chance for the Ahlul Bayt to spread the teachings of Islam.
Yes.
But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala paved the ground for Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Baqir after the event of Ashura in a way that when they started spreading the teachings of Islam, mm-hmm. they revived Islam.
Yes.
You know, because what happened in Karbala, it actually not only in that event, it was not only killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam, not only in that event Imam Hussein alayhi salam was killed, but also Islam was killed.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because you see that the way they treated the bodies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, yes, and the companions and the children of them, it was not...
And the message of Islam.
It has nothing to do, okay, with Islam.
Yes.
It was completely opposed to Islam, mm-hmm. against Islam, particularly from the ethical and moral perspective. What Imam al-Sadiq and Imam al-Baqir revived in their times was this, that they revived Islam as a whole, mm-hmm. particularly the scholarly teachings of Islam and also the moral teachings of Islam, even the political teachings of Islam, because in, yes, a way that some of the Marwanid caliphs and Amawid caliphs were attacking the other areas, the other nations, people, killed them, massacring them, arresting them, yes, as slaves, captured them. Imams were opposed to them.
Yes.
They never admitted,
okay,
this kind of behavior in terms of, let's say, political affair. Yes. That is why I think the role of A'imma alayhim salatu wassalam in all these different fields, from moral perspective, from political perspective, social, yes, perspective,
okay,
let's say jurisprudential perspective, in all of these areas, their role were very much brilliant, and they played a very great role into the spreading,
that's
the,
right,
true teachings of Islam. Mm-hmm. This is what we should focus.
Very good.
Otherwise, the Amawid caliphs and Abbasid caliphs were not able to do such things in the history of Islam.
There is a beautiful hadith by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. There are four things, little of which is also more. Fire, enmity, destitute or poverty, and sickness. You know, really beautiful ahadith from Imam al-Hussein, from Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Or for example, test your brothers in faith with two important attributes. Salat on time, if they are punctual on salat on time. And the other one is goodness to their friends, whether they are in hardships or in ease, okay, or at ease. A really fruitful ahadith from Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. Right. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi for a nice elaboration regarding the status of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam in the history of Islam. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything for granted.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Homelessness has become a serious problem in Britain. Large numbers of homeless people die on the streets of Britain every day. According to analysts, lack of cheap housing, high inflation, increasing cost of living, reduction in housing budget, and government incompetence are all contributing factors to the fact that homeless people are dying on the streets of Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to figures that highlight the stark regional differences within the United Kingdom, more than 1,300 people in the United Kingdom died while homeless last year, as cuts to health, medical and social services took their toll. Research by the charity Museum of Homelessness shows that the number of homeless people who died in 2022 was 1,313, an 85% increase on the numbers recorded by the study just 3 years earlier. The figures included people sleeping rough as well as those placed in emergency accommodation and other insecure settings. Each death was verified by a Freedom of Information request, coroner's report, charity or family member. Matt Turtle, co-founder of the Museum of Homelessness, said, "A toxic cocktail of cuts, criminalisation and crackdown is making life even harder for Britain's most vulnerable people. Just tinkering around the edges as the government plans won't fix the damage of the last 12 years. Matt Turtle added, "Far stronger policy and investment are needed to deal with the appalling loss of life. With a heavy heart, we expect to report more of the same in 2024, but with our colleagues, we will continue to do what we can to save lives." The new research showed that while there was a small year-on-year increase over the past year, 2%, the differences between England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland were significant. Fatalities in England rose by 22% to 875 cases and by 27% to 76 cases in Wales. In Northern Ireland, the number of deaths fell by 37% to 205 cases, but are more than double the level seen in 2020 after a large spike last year. Scotland's 157 deaths were a 15% decrease on the previous year. The United Kingdom-wide figures were an increase on the verified 1,286 deaths in 2021, 976 deaths in 2020, and 710 deaths in 2019. Audit by the Moat Museum of Homelessness found that most deaths occurred among people living in emergency housing or hostels, with 83% of deaths taking place when the person was in some form of accommodation. The figures also showed that 85% of those who died were under the age of 65. Matt Turtle says, "The fact that so many people continue to die in unregulated, taxpayer-funded accommodation run by rogue landlords is a disgrace." The charity said that its figures were likely to be an underestimate, as not all local authorities had replied to Freedom of Information requests, including large councils such as Birmingham Council, Blackpool Council, Ealing and Hackney. Paula Barker, a Labour MP and a Shadow Homelessness and Rough Sleeping Minister, said, "This government's track record in tackling all forms of homelessness is abysmal. It's been clear for a long time that there are deep-rooted problems across supported and temporary accommodation. Each death is a tragedy, and these figures are deeply worrying." According to the new research, the number of deaths has increased in all different categories of homeless accommodation since last year. The largest increases include those in rough sleeper accommodation and temporary accommodation, both marking 10% increases. Where the cause of death is recorded, 36% of deaths relate to drugs and alcohol use, and 10% died by suicide. Jessica Turtle, co-founder of the Museum of Homelessness, said, "The leading cause of death year on year is people dying either from drug overdose or from drug and alcohol abuse. That's a way of self-soothing, self-medication. People who usually have active addictions like that is usually because life is really hard." Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Museum of Homelessness said since 2019, more than 4,000 people have died while homeless across the United Kingdom, with someone now dying every 6.5 hours on average. Fatalities increased more than 20% in England and Wales versus 2021. Some 85% were under the age of 65. The Museum of Homelessness said, "The reliance on dangerous, unregulated temporary accommodation is contributing to deaths, alongside a broken system for mental health and addiction support." For the first time, the study specifically asked about deaths in exempt accommodation and found only 12 local authorities kept record of such information. The Museum of Homelessness said there have been growing concerns about the quality of accommodation and support, with a crisis starting in 2021 due to a lack of oversight and lack of regulation, adding that many exempt providers are abusing the system for financial gain. Of the 12 who responded, Manchester Council reported a staggering 109 deaths across 98 properties. More people died in exempt accommodation in Manchester than recorded in the whole of Wales, suggesting underreporting of the true scale of the crisis. Matt Turtle, The Museum of Homelessness's director said, "The government's misguided approach to homelessness and housing has fatal consequences. Just tinkering around the edges as government plans won't fix the damage of the last 12 years. Far stronger policy and investment are needed to deal with the appalling loss of life." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the story and tells us more. Francesca Albanese, acting director of policy and external affairs at the charity Crisis, said, "Behind each of these statistics is a human being, a life cut short and potential unrealised. The fact that anyone dies while homeless is shameful." Francesca Albanese added, "That many of these deaths are happening while in emergency or supported accommodation is shocking. These are places that should provide some respite and a foothold out of homelessness, and yet in many cases the reverse is true. We cannot let this continue." According to the charity's shelter, there were 271,000 households recorded as homeless in England only at the start of 2023. But the scale of homelessness is a notoriously difficult thing to quantify. There are many different types of homelessness, for starters. It's not just rough sleeping. There are people trapped in temporary accommodation or hostels and shelters. And it is not always a visible problem. Hidden homelessness, also known as sofa surfing, is virtually impossible to count, as people staying at friends' or relatives' homes are out of sight and often don't consider themselves to be homeless. A Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Community spokesperson claimed, "We are determined to end rough sleeping for good. That is why we published our £2 billion cross-government strategy setting out our plan to tackle homelessness and rough sleeping over the next 3 years." The Levelling Up, Housing and Community spokesperson added, "This includes £186 million to help those with drug and alcohol addiction access recovery services and up to £53 million for suitable and stable accommodation." The spokesperson claimed, "Councils have a duty to ensure temporary accommodation is suitable, and we are providing them with £654 million over the next 2 years to help prevent homelessness."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.